nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Thanks everybody from the center here for inviting me to give this presentation. I want to make clear, this is going to be like a tutorial, and I'm going to try to avoid, stay away from theory as much as I can. Sometimes you have to bring that. I'm not going to be describing the intensity equations of X-rays. You can find in any book. I'm also going to try to stick to the X-ray methods that I know you guys have available here in the instrumentation in the center, which is pretty close to what I have there. So it's going to be pretty much focusing applications, okay? And I try to squeeze as much as possible in this presentation. All right, so if I can get this thing moving on. The first slide is just an overview. It has some important information here, because when you have X-rays impinging in a surface or in a material, you get a lot of stuff going on there. We're going to describe this process in a second. But the main thing people ask, well, what is actually the space resolution of an X-ray measurement, and what's kind of the depth of penetration that we're actually having? Those numbers here are pretty much over now. You can get some things from a few nanometers to 30 to 50 microns. It depends on the material. It depends how you tune your measurement. But that's basically how deep you go. And in terms of the lateral space, you can have something with, it's typically a few centimeters. And we have instruments nowadays that are called micro diffraction instruments, where you can focus the beam to a very localized area within a few microns. And basically that's what we got. Most common radiation used is copper radiation. Of course, you can go to beamlines, you can buy specialized instruments with other radiations. This is the type of energies that are actually involved here. Now, the process that's more important for our discussion today is the coherent scattering, or actually diffraction. We have a photon coming, and basically it induces an oscillation in the electronic structure, and you have a scattered photon coming out there with exactly the same energy. There is no energy lost there. Another process, which is the incoherent or Compton scattering, you have some loss of energy here involved. Some other process we have is the fluorescence, where that photon is used to kick out one electron, and then basically that inner position is occupied by an electron that's outside. The difference in energy is almost like a signature of the material, and that's used in XRF, X-ray fluorescence, in some parts of your SEM instrument to identify what actual materials are involved. And of course, we have a situation where you can send photons, X-rays in the material, and you can kick an electron out with the Auger electrons. That's the principle of the Auger electron spectroscopy technique. In this talk, we'll be concerned about these two processes, and mainly the process of diffraction, which is the coherent scattering. Most important thing to understand when you look at X-ray data is actually the concept of real space. Let's say, for example, that you have atoms very well organized in your material. This could be throughout your whole sample. In this case, it would be a single crystal, or it could be just like a small area of the sample, like a grain in a polycrystalline material, a piece of steel, for example. You could have that situation. So basically, what we do typically is that we draw imaginary planes. You see people talk about planes a lot, but they don't exist, not planes. They're just atoms there. And you can actually draw imaginary planes, and you have the concept of despacing here. And these planes are indexed by the Miller index, HKL here. Now, the problem is the X-ray data will not show you a picture of your material in real space. What the X-ray data will show you is the representation of your sample in a weird type of space called reciprocal space, where the dimensions are exactly the opposite. So if you have something that's like a D spacing here, the dimensions there will be like almost 1 over D. So this set of planes here in the real space will correspond to a certain point in the reciprocal space. So you put all this sample there, and all the X-ray gives you is just a dot. Basically, the position of this dot, the shape of this dot, how that dot is distributed or distorted, in which direction that dot is distorted, it's a lot of information there inside that dot. When you actually sit in the lab and get an X-ray, oh, I got an X-ray peak. What you got was a cross-sectional representation of that little dot. I'm sure you hear the theoretical dot. In the end of my presentation, I'll show you how that dot really looks like. So basically here is like, you know, you are actually dating online and you are finding just like the information about the person you are going to meet. In the end of the talk, you are going to meet the real person. You'll see if you're going to be disappointed or not. Another situation we have is that if instead of picking up those plans, I pick up another set of plans, I'm going to get in that reciprocal space a point located in a different location. So depends on how the atoms are there. They are the same place, but depends how you play with the atoms that you, the plans that you select. You could be in a different orientation and you are going to get a point in a different location here. So bear in mind this situation that the position in the reciprocal space, actually it's depending on the plans that you are looking. You are going to actually use this fact at your advantage. There are some cases where you want to look at points that are actually tilted around here. Again, you'll see that in the end of my talk, if we survive that. So now, basically what we have here, that the reciprocal space is something that you have the D dimensions, and this is the 1 over D. So if you are something or somewhere that's very big in the real space, because of the 1 over D relationship, you will turn out very small and squash in the reciprocal space. Bear in mind that not the picture, but the relationship itself. Now, what the measurement does, basically the most important concepts to understand any data for an X-ray, Bragg's law and the concept of the Evoed sphere. So here I have our lattice here and a bunch of points in the reciprocal space depends on the actually plans that I'm going to select. I have an X-ray source and a detector. Typically, I get an X-ray beam coming with an angle of incidence. You get a diffracted beam there, 2 theta. This angle is very important because that's the scattering angle that we're going to look later. And then here you see in the reciprocal space the corresponding situation. So the same thing here, but we'll talk about these wave vectors there. Now, what we have is that because that you can actually define a scattering vector with the difference between these 2 vectors here, and if you assume that we have a last scattering, I mean, no loss of energy, we can actually show that there is a relationship, which is called the Bragg's law, which is actually is just 2 guys, son and his father, working together, and they both got the Nobel Prize together. It's amazing that son and dad can work together and so harmoniously. Well, God knows what was going that lab, but that's the official story anyway. So basically, the importance of this relationship is the 2D side, that if you actually, but there is an angle involved. If you measure the angle at which the X-rays is scattered out, if you measure this angle, and if you know the wavelength, you can actually measure something microscopically inside there by measuring angle. You can get information about a microstructure, the atomic D space. It is extremely powerful. And the fact that this relationship is so simple perhaps was the reason that the technique really exploded in usage. I can imagine that if this relationship had like a triple integration with some gradients or something really scary there, maybe people, I'm not going to bother about using this because it's so complicated. But it's very, very simple here. So that's Bragg's law. Okay, enough of the theory. Okay, then in the reciprocal space, we have this concept of an Evoed sphere. You can actually imagine that this whole scattering process that you see in your lab in the reciprocal space, thanks to this guy called Evoed, you can actually imagine like an imaginary sphere with a radius equal to the wave vector that you have. And when this actually, we do the experiment in the reciprocal space, you have this ball, this sphere running down there, like, you know, the big Indiana Jones ball running towards you. And as long as you hit a spot, the surface hit a spot, poop, you get 1 peak. All right, let's move on. Basically what we learned from the previous slides is that the information that you get from the sample, you have an X-ray, you get actually a diffraction cone, and if the material is single crystal, you get some spots here, discrete spots. If it's a polycrystalline material or a random powder, everything is distributed in circles. And if the material is like, has a polycrystalline, just prefer it, you get like discrete rings. This actually points to you one major problem. You can see here if your sample is actually completely random, let's say a piece of steel with no texture or a powder that's completely random. When you do a measurement, actually your detector moves. What it's doing is going across these rings. So you're actually going to see a peak here and here, those 2 peaks. Now, if you actually do the same measurement in a sample that has a single crystal structure, then you have to be more careful because it depends on the direction that you are moving your detector. You may hit a spot or you may not hit it at all. That's why a single crystal measurement is more complicated, and Monica knows well about that, than actually just sticking a powder there and running. And you have a problem that many people try to run texture samples, samples that have preferred orientation in a conventional powder refractometer, and what they do? They just go across here, they miss a peak here, and they just see one peak. Oh, your sample has just one peak. Actually, it has many. So nowadays, the newer instruments, they have like instead of a point detector, they have a line detector or an aerial detector where you can see the whole picture in one single frame. So this is just to alert you that you have to choose carefully. The X-ray instrument and capabilities that you are going to use depend on the material that you are going to deal with. The most basic type of measurement you get is the called couple 2 theta omega scan. You read papers, you say, oh, we did a theta 2 theta scan. What in the world is this? Basically, I have a little animation of what is going on. You have an X-ray source. The sample is rotating, and the detector is rotating twice the speed. You can see here that in the relative direction to the surface, the beams is almost like showing like a mirror type of reflection. So both of these guys are moving. The omega and 2 theta are changing during the measurement. Now, sorry to bring the reciprocal space thing on here. Basically, what is going on when you do this measurement, actually, when you do this measurement, you are actually probing information in the direction along this plane, perpendicular to the planes. So the conventional theta 2 theta scan you see a lot in your publications is just probing the information across these planes, jumping from one to the other one. Therefore, it's a very, very good technique to find out when these planes change. When do the planes change in size, in separation? When you have new materials. If you have a material A and B, so you probe around, you're going to see different materials there. So basically, you can use this for phase identification, lattice constants, grain size, and so on. But it does not give you too much information about the actual quality of the material. That's why the next type of scan comes handy, which is called rocking curve. It's just a fancy name for something that's just like only the sample is like rocking. It's like a baby inside the crib. You just rock. You see here? Only the sample is rocking. And you can see that in this way, you are probing an orientation that goes almost along the planes. Any distortion, irregularity, or break on these planes that you have because of defects, mosaicity, you'll be able to pick it up. So ideally for thin film people, some of you may be thin film guys, you may want to do this measurement as well. Okay? We're going to talk more about that. So these probes actually texture, spectral strains, and mosaicity and defects in the material. Now, what is the contrast information I can get from X-ray data? Basically, here I have, again, my sample running, tireless, is running complete, and then I have the data being acquired. And I see here the sample, and what you see is that as you increase the angle of incidence, you are actually going deeper in the sample. You also, because you are increasing the angle, the illuminated area is actually getting shorter and shorter. So actually, the amount of the surface that you are probing with X-ray varies a little bit, and you should be careful about that. Another thing that's very, very important here, we are, you see the grains that have yellow. We are just probing with this type of measurement, the grains that, the crystallographic planes that are parallel to the surface or parallel to the diffraction planes. These other guys here in white are completely being missed. So if you have, that's why if, when you do a powder measurement, you take a powder sample, they ask you to grind it to make it very random because these guys that you are missing, since it's random, they will be rotated down here in the sample and they will show up. If your sample is not random, with this measurement, you are going to miss a lot of grains there. That's why, for example, if you take like a piece of a thin film, for example, you are going to just see just a few peaks because just some of the grains will be exposed if it's textured. Okay, this is the first alert. This is not going to show you all the information. So now, what we get from the X-ray? From the peak position, I mean, where the peaks are located, you can identify the material. It's almost like a fingerprinting. There is no two materials that you give a totally all the same peaks there. So you can identify pretty much not only the elements, but you can find out what kind of structure, for example, is present. For example, titanium oxide. Based on the peak positions, you can identify if it's a titanium oxide called anatase or rutile. Not only the elements present, but which kind of form. The same with iron oxide. So it's used a lot for this kind of identification. Lattice parameter and so on. The width of the peak, talk about how fat or how slim the peaks are, you can use to calculate crystallite size, strain, and defects. The area of the peak, you can calculate the preferred orientation. That means how much percentage of the grains are actually more oriented in one direction than the other one. The tails of the peak, you can use to find the diffusive scattering and calculate point defects. And the background can be used to find the amorphous contents. So basically, in an X-ray measurement, we use everything. We are almost like a green technique that we don't waste anything. We use even the background, background, let's we throw this away. There is information there. So now the first thing is that the typical powder diffraction methods, which is basically like you have the basics where the technique started being actually very strong. And again, all these techniques that I'm going to describe here, you can actually do in John's machine. So basically it's a plug there. You can, everything is available here. What you want to do is find out what lattice constant we have, if the material is crystalline or not, the grain size and so on. Basically, configuration, you get an X-ray source. The beam is actually prepared from some slits, shines in the sample, sees has an opening here, and it converts back in the detector there. And you have this, all these drawings here. I'm not going to go in detail. This looks like this mad scientist drawing on seeing boards. Not going to go in detail, but just remember that you have the beam is prepared in the way to the sample and out of the sample to reach a detector here. The wavelength is separated through a monochromator down there. One example, very simple. This was like for one of thesis work of the students that they have a commercial toaster that was actually failing. So they took a piece of the quartz piece, the material there. They did an X-ray and found just this. What is no peak at all? What does mean no peak? There is nothing crystalline there. So it's amorphous. You see the big typical hump of amorphous there. And then you get like this is called the fused quartz complete disorder. This is the good toaster. The toaster that were actually giving trouble, they were actually showing peaks. And these peaks, by comparing the peak positions with the database, we found out that it was a form of quartz, and that's particular structure here. What was happening in that case is that this glass here was actually getting crystallized, and that was a bad thing for them. You see, most of the thin film people, when they actually grow some film that's amorphous, they almost kill it themselves because it's bad, but sometimes amorphous is a good thing, especially in this industrial application here. So you saw that the previous slide, X-ray can be used at very basic to find out if it's crystalline or not. Now, the width of the peak, how fat or how slim this peak is, can be used to calculate what we call the crystallite size. What is crystallite size is actually the coherent domain that's responsible for this peak. Now, if you approximate that this crystallite is the size of a grain, or the size of your nanoparticle, you have a very valuable tool to identify for you from a single measurement what's the size of the nanoparticle or what's the size of the grains. And that has a huge impact in many of the applications. We have people who do like iron oxide nanoparticles in X-rays to find out the structure, and you get through that 2-theta-theta scan. And by fitting the peaks, they found, oh, my par nanoparticle is 7 nanometer. Great. Oh, it's actually 14. Oh, I have to go back to the lab. And so on. Now, I'm not going to go in detail here, but there is a whole discussion about how you actually fit this peak, because you have to actually insert an instrumental correction. And you might hear in papers something called Scherer's equation. Basically, what happens is that you just take the full width half maximum of that peak, you take like the position of the peak, a bunch of constants, and you can get like approximately the size of the nanoparticle or the size of the crystallite that's involved there. Now, one thing that we have to bear in mind, that again, we're just picking up particles that actually have the crystallographic planes parallel to the surface. These other guys here, we don't have. It happens a lot of thin films where there is a growth in a tubular form or like long things. So if you measure the crystallographic, if you measure actually the grain size in one direction is huge, on the other direction is going to be small. So I'm not going to go into detail. You see 10 examples. You see that's inversely proportional to the size. If you have a silicon powder, which is very, very sharp, it gives very sharp peaks, you have a very large crystallite size, like an iron oxide nanoparticle, a huge broad peak, 2 nanometer size and so on. You can use that for actually finding the size. And it comes already built in your data. There is nothing more that you need to worry about. This is just a few warnings that I typically, in a longer workshop, I would go more in details. But you have to fit your peak carefully, correct for instrument, broadening and so on. And if you are actually this is a warning. Actually, if you do, depends on the methodology you do. If you don't have your instrument calibrated well, you can have grain size that are different by almost a factor of 2. So the message here is to, grain size, great to do. But first, make sure that you have the right calibrations. Second, be consistent. Because sometimes sample A, you will get a grain size that that number is not correct. But when you compare A, B, C, and D, even though that the values are not accurate, the relative change from one to the other one might be just what you need. You can also actually include a strain. What is a strain? A distortion in the lattice can be actually affect the broadening of the peak. There is a method that you can actually add both of these decomposition, the width from the strain. It has this equation here, and then you can add the shear equation there, and you get this Williamson-Hall method. What it is? In a nutshell, what you want to have with this carry with you for lunch today? Okay, I need like a 2 or 3 peaks from my data, and then basically I'm going to actually get the full width half max for all these 3 peaks, and then I'm going to correct for the instrument. I'm going to use this equation. Most of these instruments already come with the software ready for you to do that, and then you are going to plot this in this form and that form. Good. So what happens that the intercept here in this plot give you the size. And the slope will give you the microstrain. Again, for a simple 2-theta-theta scan, you can already have strain size information besides your typical typical phase analysis. How I'm doing with the time? Okay, so going to the next. This is more like other methods that you could use, more advanced for grain analysis, so I'm not going to go over that. One typical example, XRD from corals. We have some samples that were corals from the sea. We prepare them so that the top surface is flat. So the main question for people working this is how the skeleton of that gets mineralized, what kind of compounds are present there. So we just did one X-ray data with a high background. The first, you see the tetraposition intensity, you get this background here because of the way we mount the sample on a glass. So we do a background correction. Most of the software can do this for you. And then we actually did a peak fit. What do we mean? We're trying to tell the software where my peaks are, and we're going to fit them with a very detailed shape. The software gained, okay, we have a crystallite on that coral, 85 nanometers. Well, that's just from the width of the peak. Now we took those peaks and we run against a database of materials called PDF, powder diffraction files. In a nutshell, it's like if the FBI comes to your house, collects your fingerprint, and runs your fingerprint against the database of criminals. So basically, that's what we do basically here. Not that the sample is a criminal, but you got the picture there, right? So we have to have the materials in the database, and we have 500,000 materials in that database. So when we actually compare this either manually or through the software, we actually found out that all the peaks, not only in terms of deposition, but in terms of the intensity ratio, they match something called aragonite, which is just this calcium carbon in oxygen here, so it's a capital there. And we found the structure, the space group, and everything, and no calcite or silicate were present. So don't worry about too much these details. What I'm showing you is just from an X-ray data, we'll also be able to find the atomic structure of this material. So, and then the preferred orientation, I mean, the relative height of the peaks actually gave information to the scientists about what the processes involve in terms of how the skeleton of the coral gets thicker and thicker. There's a work that was done with Kruger from England. So basically, this is a similar data, but this is from a mixture. So you have here like an X-ray data, and then after doing this, what you call search match, which you can remember, the FBI search, we got much like a rutile, hematite, and anatase, so these materials. And not only you can identify all this stuff I talked about, but we can actually do a quantitative information there. From the area of the peaks, we can find out how much percent we have of all these three. So by just sticking your powder there, and actually running this, you get a lot of information. Like yesterday, I had people bringing like sands from the river. They want exactly this. They had no clue what is there. Sometimes you know, sometimes you don't know. We found there, we give them the percentage. That's a good deal. Now, the fact that the technique is so quick to apply, the fact the basic equation is simple, and main thing is actually it's a fingerprinting technique where you can identify the materials, and it's quantitative. You can get numbers out of it. That is the main driving force that has brought the technique to be so powerful, it's so popular. And you can also go even deeper, doing like a rich file refinement, where you are going to have your data and you are going to actually fit this through an algorithm that's actually due to rich file, and you are going to actually find out even more details about the atomic position there. So that's everything from your actually powder data. And the beauty about X-ray technique is that you go as much as you want. It's like you go to a restaurant, you can just eat your entry is there, you can go the whole meal. You can actually spend time by doing actually rich field refinement, finding more details on the structure. Let me move on now for something, I don't know how many people here do actually thin films, that techniques that are more applied for thin films. And that's very close to the configuration that John Coy has here, the parallel beam optics. The basic, this is very good if you have samples that are very rough, like, you know, pieces, for example, of steel that are a bit deformed, or thin films, or you want to look just at the top layers of your material. So a typical parallel beam configuration, remember the optics I showed before, where the X-ray beam diverges in the sample. In this case, it goes exactly parallel in the sample, and sometimes it goes exactly parallel to the detector as well. So that's the typical, what's the advantage of this type of optics? It's twofold, that you actually get more intensity through because of these parallel plate collimators, and also you have, it's less sensitive to the accurate position of your sample. If your sample is slightly off in the diffractometer, or if the surface is very, very rough here, some time ago I got a piece of steel that has been actually fired, the surface was really regular, that kind of very ugly thing, and we could do with a parallel beam configuration because it doesn't care too much if your sample is distorted, right? You see the example actually that we had with the toaster. The glass was tilted. That's what we use, the parallel beam configuration. And this thing is exactly what you guys have here in the lab. The configuration is similar to that. One example, thin film applications. One of the researchers in the group, Professor Petrov, they actually grew tantalum nitride thin films on magnesium oxide. They had done this by sputtering. They grew at different energy. They said, well, is the film crystalline at all or not? First thing, just do the basics. Run a 2-theta-theta scan, and you can see here that you have a 002 substrate peak because of the O1 orientation, and from all possible tantalum nitride peaks that they could have, they actually found just one set of peaks which corresponds to the O2. Now, when you remember that this type of scan is probing the lattice planes parallel to the surface, what you are finding out is that your tantalum nitride for all these various configurations here of sputtering is growing at the 1-1-0-1 orientation like the substrate. Is going aligned to the substrate. So basically that's the conclusion from this simple step. Now here you can see depends on the energy that you use. You have like a stronger or weak peak, some lattice distortion. There is a whole science to discuss here, but that's basically the first conclusion. Now the next question is, okay, good. I know that how the whole thing is in the surface, but how about sideways? Does this tantalum nitride cube sits exactly on top of the other cube or sits rotated? So then what we actually can do, we actually choose another set of planes that are tilted. Remember when I told you in the one of the first slides, sometimes you want to pick up a spot that's tilted to the side, the tilted plane. So that's what we want to do because with these tilted planes here, you can investigate the size of this, the side of the cube. Then what we did, we focused on these reflections and we spin the sample around the surface normal. That's what we got, that these peaks are at the tantalum nitride are exactly aligned with MgO, which proves that exactly this cube sits nicely on top of the other one. That's the substrate. And basically you got this cube on cube epitaxy. Now if you work with like aluminum gallium nitride materials or gallium nitride materials, you see that this is not as beautiful like that. They tend to sit on each other but rotate 30 degrees. An X-ray can actually bring that information to you. Now, one thing that people use a lot, glancing angle. It's basically similar to the scan we did, but it has a difference that you come with an X-ray beam towards your surface at a very small angle. Why you want to do that? Because you want to have the X-ray beam only sensitive to the top layers there, or you want your X-ray beam shining just on top of the surface. Because if I change this angle of incidence, my beam is going to go deeper. So with the industry making materials and thin films that are thinner and thinner, on the nanometer scale now, it's very important to have a technique where you can probe that kind of depth. I'm not caring about what's down there. I want my top layer, what is going on. And this is it. It's available in your instrument. You can do that. Just fix your angle of incidence very small and actually collect the data. By doing that, you are going to be very sensitive to the surface, and you get one plus additional thing that you will be able to probe grains that are also tilted in addition to the ones that are not tilted. This is just like an explanation of what's going on here. What these curves show is the penetration depth of X-ray as you increase the angle of incidence. Of course, it depends on the material, the type of radiation. But here you have, for example, from light to actually very heavy materials. And just concentrate, what you can see at the very high angles, the penetration depth levels off. But the advantage that at very low angles, and I have a zoom of that picture here, if you play with angles that are below 1 degree, you can actually set up the X-ray penetration depth, depends on what you want on the material. You can be very surface sensitive. So using this technique, I'll give you an example. Well, you can actually do a high sensitivity ultra, and you can also play. If you do different experiments at different angle of incidence, you can also probe different depths. You can also do a depth profile of the structure that's involved. One example, it's a polysilicon gate in CMOS technology. Basically, silicon substrate and a polysilicon material. In the red color here, the red ones is a conventional 2-theta-theta scan. You can see here that you have this huge Godzilla big peaks. They're taking over the whole space. There's no room for anybody to show a few red peaks here, but not so much information. Now, when you actually do the glancing angle, you look at the blue, you don't go deep enough, so you don't touch the substrate. And all the peaks that you see, the blue ones, have more intensity, are more well-resolved. These are from your thin film. So this is used very much when you have situations where you want to avoid the substrate peak, for example. Another thing that we move on is actually a concept that you can use your instrument for actually probe texture and preferred orientation. I talked to this about this for a while, but what is this? You guys are now, at least most of you, are in a preferred orientation. Most of you are looking at me. So that means it's like if you have all the grains in your material towards one direction, that's a preferred orientation. Even if a few of you, for example, one guy is sleeping in the back there, the other drink a coffee, the other is tying his shoes, that's basically, it's okay. Now, a situation where everything is random is like during the break. If there is no food around, nobody's going to look around. So basically, there is no food around, nobody's going to be oriented. So break, everybody looks everywhere. That's a random orientation. Now, why are we doing this? I mean, this is so, theoretical. Actually, this has a huge impact. I cannot tell you how many projects I saw from the industry that people were just looking at for the copper films. Did the copper film grow with a certain preferred orientation or not? And that's now people that know didn't grow the orientation we want. Go back. They have to repeat that. Because that has an impact in the electronic properties, etching properties, and everything you do on that material. So this is really, really money, big money involved there. So what we want to do is that we want to show X-ray methods where you can actually find out what actually is the orientation of most of the grains and what kind of fraction we have for this orientation. So this is a long list of different methods, not going to go over there. But one of the things that we use very often, and that's again, it's a picture of a drawing of a goniometer, exactly like the one that John Coy has here. Basically, you have an X-ray source, have the angle of incidence, the diffracted angle, but you are going to use the tilt angle, the angle that the sample tilts back and forth, and the spinning of the sample, phi. By using that, and if you say, for example, okay, you did your 2-theta-theta scan, you found some peaks there. Now you focus in one of these peaks, and you're going to say, okay, I want to find out how many grains are actually oriented towards that particular orientation, with that particular orientation. So then when you do that, you do something called pole figure, which is a crystallographic projection here. And basically you can see from these contours, you have like the plane plot, and you have a perspective view. You can see that for a certain angle, you have most of the grains or 111 located. So towards an angle going out here and down there, that's where most of your grains are actually oriented. A measurement like this takes half an hour. It's unattended. You just press a key, go drink your coffee, come back, it's ready for you. You can't beat that, right? You get all this information involved there, and so you can quantify things. Now, if you do pole figures from different reflection, 111, 200, and something, you can build what we call the ODF, orientation distribution function, which shows you in a more complicated plot what fractions, what density of grains are in a particular orientation. Guess who was actually very much involved in a project like this? Ford. So they were actually taken to our lab, the cover sheets of the cars, and that submitted to like rolling, and they want to find out who actually that rolled metal, what kind of preferred orientation we get, and they are trying to tune that preferred orientation to take the material harder. So when you hit someone in the parking lot, for example, it will be less damage, it will be more safe. Big money involved on that. They were actually sponsored a PhD student. Just look at that. So I just try to put in perspective that these things, they are not theoretical. They are just, and this is pretty easy measurement to do. The basics of the pole figure is like if you have a set of crystallographic planes and you draw the surface normal here, you can actually make a projection through this sphere and you see where that you project that plane down, you get a spot here. The position of the spot in the polar plot, that's the kind of plot that I know you guys love. You guys love from the mathematics, right? As you go from the center to the edge is the tilt, and this is the phi rotation, you get a spot here. Depends on where you get your point, that's where the planes are tilting towards. So by look, a point here means that you have some planes oriented towards a certain direction that you can read from here exactly. So this is used also, again, for the case of thin films. For example, here you have, let's say if you have a sample, we'd have a cubic crystal, and basically you have all your little cubes inside aligned towards this direction here. And then depends on the kind of orientation if you look at the pole figure. If you look, for example, at the 100 pole figure for this type of sample, you get dots here. If you look at the 111, you get dots more in the middle. So basically, this, I did the thing opposite. In typical situation, you don't know how your sample look inside, right? You are not Superman. You don't have like the eyes that can look. This part you don't know. You do a set of pole figures, and based on this arrangement, you work your way back to find, okay, I found my little cubes inside actually are exactly parallel to the surface. And I have other slides where it shows if the thing is tilted or not. But what I want you to carry here is that the position of the spots on that pole plot gives exactly the arrangement of the structure that you have there. And then when you say that each one of these is just half an hour, it's pretty convenient. Now, one more detail about the texture. Here, for example, the case of the thin film of copper that's done for the industry, they run a 2-theta-theta scan, and you see just copper 111 and 222. Where are the other copper peaks? Because according to the powder database, we should see other peaks around there as well. Where they are? That's because this is a texture film. All the grains are parallel to the surface towards the 111. It says here. So basically, when you do a pole figure, you see actually the maximum peak for the 111. When you look at the tilted planes, we see, however, that in the direction of on the side of parallel to the surface, it's completely random. We have what we call here a fiber texture. And for everybody who grows thin film, especially if you deal with metals, on semiconductors, you are going to see that a lot. So basically, it's very highly oriented for the directions of the growth. But in the implant direction, it's completely random. We could go on. You can use that to quantify even defects in your material. Residual stress is something that people use a lot. And again, it's just built in your instrumentation to do that. I'm doing here, okay. So what is the residual stress? It's a different thing. It's the stress that remains the sample after your process has finished. Which process is that? It could be that you heated your sample, you anneal it. It could be that you cool it down. It could be that during the growth, you grow the sample, after it cools down, it gets like a stress. What means it has some actually expansion or compression in the grains, in the atomic planes. And you can actually use the X-ray technique to do that. I know of one company, big company in Illinois, that bought an X-ray machine to do day in and day out residual stress measurement in steel samples because it's an important thing for their huge machines. You can guess which company is that, but basically that's how important this thing is. And I don't want to actually know stress you or make you dizzy with all these pictures. I just want you to concentrate on this picture here. What we did is that typically we do a 2-theta-theta scan, okay? And we found a peak. Then we take a certain peak, preferably at very high angle, and we scan for that peak at different tilts of the sample. And then we measure how that peak shifts. And after a bunch of corrections, we make a plot where from where you can extract the actual residual stress. Very, very simple. Has some approximation here, but nowadays we have much more methods to calculate stress in different directions in the sample. So for an X-ray, you cannot quantify, but you can determine if it's compressive or tensile. And the psi square method, which this method I just described, is one that's the most important one. Nowadays, people are using even the Glancy angle method combined to this to have a depth profile of the stress in your sample. Last part of the presentation is the high resolution or thin film. What happens if you have a single crystal or if you have the materials that are very highly perfect, where the distortion, the lattice, the change is just like with 10^-5 or less? How do you do? Use high resolution. What high resolution is? Basically, the principle is here. You remember the Evolt sphere that nobody likes, nobody understands? That's the Evolt sphere. What I'm trying to tell you here, if you have the incident beam and the diffracted beam, the uncertainty depends on your optics of the incident beam will reflect that this sphere will have a smearing around that. So in theory, in practice, nothing works as a theory, as you know. So you have like an smearing of the sphere. So basically, each one of your dots in the reciprocal space will have like a finite uncertainty. So with the high resolution techniques, we try to bring this thing as small as possible. And by doing what? By actually having very accurate position of the primary beam and the detector, and the secondary beam. And how we'll do that? This is a configuration that, again, very close to what you guys got here in-house. We have actually, it's done through a monochromator where the beam actually reflects 4 times, get to the sample. And once it comes out there, it comes almost like, you know, the super X-ray beam, because it actually comes with a very small angular spread. So the beam is so parallel. In conventional X-ray, that beam is within like a 0.1 degrees. When it comes out there, it's 0.003 degrees, extremely parallel. I have friends who joke that this is like, you know, X-ray with steroids, because basically actually very parallel. And the wavelength is extremely well defined with 10^-5. Another thing on the detector side, you put a bunch of crystals there again, so you define your opening, the position, the acceptance of the detector very small. So in a high resolution X-ray instrument, you'll see these crystals in front of the sample, after the sample, and the idea is actually to limit angularly what you see there. Some examples. This technique actually evolved from like indium gallium arsenide. You see indium arsenide and gallium arsenide multilayers. You can actually find this periodicity here. We actually have done measurements with John about that. Here, like a silicon germanium superlattice, where you can find the substrate, very, very sharp peak, quantum dots as well. And one of the examples I want to show you is, for example, let's say an indium gallium arsenide alloy on a gallium arsenide substrate. And the difference in atomic spacing from the film and the substrate is extremely small. Very small. So when you do an X-ray measurement in high resolution, see the separation of the two peaks, 0.07 degrees. If you take your old grandmother X-ray diffractometer, and that's not high resolution, and run this, you'll just see a big blob peak here. High resolution will give you that separation. And you also can see the fringes, which arise because the interface are very sharp. Boom. You can calculate from this the actually percentage of the alloy, and you can calculate the thickness. There is a company in town, in Champaign-Urbana, that they spend all the time actually doing these 3-5 structures to sell to the industry. And they have their own X-ray machine doing this all the time to probe thickness and so on. Now, I told you that in the end of this talk, I was going to show you what the real dots, the reciprocal space dots actually look like. And I'm sorry to break the news, they look like this. So if you have a material that's extremely nice single crystal, you have this should be a dot. This should be a dot for the film. They are actually don't look like dots because they have these elongations here. This is just an artifact for the detector. In the vertical direction is because you have the crystal truncation rod that limits the size of the crystal in the surface normal direction. So basically how they look. If the material is defective, like relaxed, so you have, for example, the peak looks really broad and ugly, and it's actually rotated. Look at the relative position between them. One of the toughest problems to tackle this is the what they call the strained silicon. You start with the silicon substrate, you grow a very thick silicon germanium, and you grow a silicon top. Why you want to do that? Well, industry is putting a lot of money there. They want to have a strained silicon to explore better optical electronic properties on that layer. So basically what we have, when you look at the tilted planes, the dots will be at different locations. So we do what we call reciprocal space map. Well, we do a scan first. It doesn't show you too much, just a bunch of shoulders. Now, when you do like a reciprocal space map, it's like this. If you look at these peaks that we saw here, it's like if you could see this from the top in a two-dimensional distribution in a much higher resolution. This is not like your Thanksgiving turkey on the table. This is actually the distribution of these dots. This is the substrate peak. This is the silicon germanium peak. That's your strain layer. You see they are completely aligned in this direction, so it grew straight. From the location, you can get actually all the numbers that you may wish or not for, strain, percentage, and so on from a measurement like this. Also, if you look careful at the shape of the peaks, how they are elongated, and which direction they are elongated, you can identify most these locations, and you can even calculate density of these locations here. The shape of the peak is a very important thing. And now is the very, now I promise, the very last thing is reflectivity, which is a technique where you go very glancing, but you don't worry too much about the crystallinity. And basically you have the two teta-teta scan going on at very small angles. You get a total reflection area. You get a decay here because the beam is now penetrating your sample. The sharper this decay is, it tells you about the roughness. You can fit this for the roughness. And if you see these fringes here, in this case, you see a double set, you can actually find the thickness in the material. Again, I cannot tell you how many companies we see buying X-ray machines just to do reflectivity. Many big companies are doing ALD, atomic layer deposition of aluminum oxide, halfin oxide. They always buy an X-ray machine to do this. What's the big deal there? It's because we can actually measure things that are very thin, like a couple of nanometers. See, this is a very ultra-thin material, a multi-layers, amorphous film. You can get it done. This is a case of like a polymer. Very hard to do, just a couple of nanometers. You can do through fittings. Basically, now the summary of the talk about X-ray is that things that you want to see, we talk about a lot, this thing here, you can measure thickness, roughness, stress, lattice constant, and so on. This is the kind of industry that we serve. I'm going to make this presentation available for you guys to download or look at all these numbers. Now, one thing that's important is that how does X-ray compares with the other techniques? So it's a very neutral and impartial presentation about that. So basically what we see, this is very important because people come to my lab and I think our instrument is broke. Why? Well, I measure the grain size here and I go in the SCM, I get different number. Your machine is not good. It's always my machine. Basically, what happens, why? Well, let's say here, sample preparation, very minimal sample preparation required for X-rays. If it's a no sample, you have no clue about, you have to make it in powder. But most of the time, you just stick it there. There's no need for vacuum compatibility. It could be even a dead thing sample. We have measured piece of mummy there. So, no problem. You just stick there. There's no need to be clean, completely clean. What kind of impurity detection limits we have? If you see a peak in X-ray, it means it's at least 0.1 to 1% present. It's not the greatest sensitivity, but the other techniques in the market that are available, they require vacuum compatibility. They require like you know, pumping down or depth profile and destroying your sample, which is a good thing to do if you can live with that. In terms of lattice constant, that is really where X-ray shines out. It's hard to find techniques that will give a better measurement of, more accurate measurement of lattice constant than X-ray. You can get film thickness in X-rays. And I have a lot of people who does reflectivity. And basically they were also doing like, you know, Raman or ipsometry measurement. And then basically they say, well, it's both ways. The one thing that they feel uncomfortable about the ipsometry is that they need to model. They need to embed, put optical constants there, where most of the times with reflectivity is just simple. You see just the separation of the two peaks, invert that to the real space. That's your thickness. So basically, these are complementary techniques, but there's plus and minus there. Grain size. Oh gosh, I have so much question about this. If people measure grain size in X-ray, remember, you are measured just in one direction and you are doing a volume average and it's average over a huge area. The guy goes and put the same sample in the microscope, sees a very small localized area, sees a different number, comes to fight with me. You have to remember, are your probe size the same? Are you average number or volume? So basically, these techniques are complementary, but when you compare one number with the other, you have to make sure that you are not comparing tomatoes with potatoes. And other things like, one major thing, stress and texture. X-ray does a big average of your sample. It doesn't hide. Now, in some cases, people want to just look at a certain grains. X-ray will not do that. Then you have EBSD to do that. So depends on what, but bear in mind when you compare this technique. Now, the thing the X-ray doesn't really do a fantastic job is in the identifying the defects and quantifying them. You get some kind of semi-empirical quantification of dislocation, defects, and so on, where an optical electron microscopy will do a better job. Overall, the X-ray machines are actually much cheaper. Have a typical type of samples you can do, as I told you, big things, pig tissues, organics, sands, paintings, dead things, mummy, electronic chips. And of course, the most important of all the samples that has happened so far, which actually the sample that start perhaps like this, honey, come here to the lab and stick your head inside this X-ray machine. I promise it's not going to hurt at all. So this is actually how X-ray started, when actually Rodgen invited his wife to actually take an X-ray from her hand. And that's the picture there. She did not die from that experiment, but that's actually the thing that kicked out all the X-ray experimentations, was actually from the presence of a woman, as usual. They always have an important presence in everyone in science. So this work is supported by the DOE, and as Monica said, please come to our workshop next year in the summer. They have the dates here. The registrations will open in January. You can send me an email to, if you want me to put you on your announcement list. And we're going to cover all the techniques that we have available there. And also comparing, there will be also industry present with some presentations there. Well, that's all I had to do. I know I went over the time. It was a very good in terms of try to compact what I could. Many more details I couldn't go, but I'll be available for any questions. I think I'll be a little bit in the afternoon here if you need to go in detail. So, any questions?
Do you measure the residual stress measurement? Is it for the film or?
Either way, we have done for thin films, for case of bulk measurement as well. It depends on the peak you choose. So you do a 2-teta-teta scan, sometimes you see like a thin film peak. If that's what you interest, you're actually going to probe that peak for the residual stress. If it's something deeper down there, like a piece of steel, for example, you just pick one piece of the steel. Okay. Yeah?
The penetration depth, is that what limits the thickness of the thin film that you can measure?
Well, no. Yeah, well, good question here. What is actually, I get this question a lot. How thick do I need to have my thin film to get a good X-ray data? So it goes like with penetration depth is one thing, but it goes like this. It depends on the crystalline quality. So if your film has extremely high crystalline quality, like an epitaxial material, we have measured even 50 nanometers or less, 20 nanometers. But your film, if your film is 20 microns and it's completely amorphous, you're going to see no peak at all, just like a bunch of humps in the background. So it goes hand to hand with the material quality. Now, if you actually are going to grow a film to test an X-ray, on an overall, you want to keep something around 100 nanometers if you can. Having said that, we have measured much thinner than that. Now, if you have, for example, a layer that has, for example, multi-layer that's very thick, like one layer like 50 microns, the second one is down there 100 microns, the then basically you have a problem with your penetration depth because X-ray has to go through all that thing and come back. Most of the time, we have the opposite problem. They said, no, I don't want to see what's under. I just want to see the top one. That's why glancing angle is very useful for us. Any more questions? Yes, go ahead.
The substrate is amorphous. Then for the traditional theta measurement, the grazing will be the same result.
If the substrate, good question. So basically, if the substrate is amorphous, that means no peaks in the substrate there. So how do you handle that? Well, you can in principle, that's what we, people in that situation, if it's a thin film, we still do not put them, we still have them starting all the time with a 2-theta-theta scan. But the question is, which machine? So a powder machine could give you a misleading result because you put your thin film there, and that thin film could grow with texture, even though under it is just like, you know, amorphous substrate. Most of the time will not have too much texture. So a powder thin film, if that's all you have, you can use that. But you should be aware that, aware that it could be a problem. If you have texture, you may be missing information there. So. Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
So, for X-ray measurement, it's hard to detect very small area samples. So now is there any way to
Excellent question. I have this question all the time. I have a sample. Let's say for example, you have a sample. It could be like an electronic device with a pad there. And you say, well, how can you do the measurement here? Yes. In a normal way, what you do, you put your sample, you point to that pad, and you blast an X-ray beam, but you are going to spill the beam outside, and hopefully the materials that are outside from the pad are different from the pad, and you'll be able to distinguish them. In some situations, people say, no, actually, I can't go outside there. So basically, you have two situations. You have to find a ways to cover the outside area with something that's going to be amorphous, or you can use new instrumentations where you have, or even you can buy upgrades for the expert machines where you have this kind of a capillary where actually it's like big long tubes and you can buy them according to the size that you need. Actually, it's going to, mainly it's through optical fibers. It focuses the beam to a very small spot and make sure that, and then you have a laser system with a video that shows you real time with a crosshair, you know, like this bombing in Iraq, they show where they're going to bomb. They do the same thing. You go there and then show there in the sweet spot exactly where you want to do, and you click a mouse and it takes the X-ray juice from that layer. They are more expensive instruments. You can buy a completely new one or you can just upgrade instrument like that. So micro diffraction is a way. Oh, thank you.